Hi everyone, and welcome to this latest episode of the UKIS ITEL podcast. And this week I'm really happy to welcome Michael Ignatieff. You'll all know of him if you don't know him. He's a Canadian academic, author, TV host, and former politician who's very well known for his insights on democracy, on human rights, and on global affairs. On democracy and human rights, he's led them. He sort of lived them in his real life recently as head of the Central European University, which was in Budapest. Michael, welcome.
Great to be here, Anand.
You've had such a long and illustrious career that I slightly despair of trying to talk to you about all the things I want to in half an hour. But I want to start, if I may, with a book that was originally published in the 90s, Blood and Belonging, 1993, I believe, that has just been republished. And the book discusses ethnic conflict and nationalism and their role in shaping global politics. And I suppose the obvious first question is, how has your perspective on these things changed since you originally wrote it all those years ago?
Great question, Anand. I think what I'm tempted to say right out of the bat is that I was right then and I'm right now. That is to say, the one thing I did see in the early 90s, when people were celebrating the end of communism, the end of the Iron Curtain, and the reunification of Europe, The thing I saw, and it was, I can't claim any insight, it was just thrust into my face by circumstances, was that when democracy came to Eastern Europe, it came in the form of ethnic majority rule and ethnic cleansing. That is, if you were a Croat and you were forming a state, or you were a Serb forming a state and having an election, your key question would be how the minorities would vote. And your worry if you were a minority was, what will happen if the Croats get to power, or what will happen if I'm a Croat in Serbia and the Serbs get to power? And so democracy, far from being this wonderful liberation, created an enormous political problem in each of these societies. And I think you need to see it that way, as a political problem, rather than the kind of surging up from below of immemorial tribal passions. No. There was a real problem. How do you create a democracy where there's never been a democracy before, where there is a history going back to the Second World War of inter-ethnic war and conflict and killing? How can you stabilize a democracy that has majority rule and minority rights protection? And no one in Yugoslavia got that right. And so the place exploded into really a decade of ethnic war. And that was a very formative time for me, because I'd spent some time there as a child because of the accident. My father was posted there as a diplomat. So I lived it very personally. Okay. I'd seen a Yugoslavia under socialism, which was a tyranny, but it held together. And then it just exploded in the 90s. So that, to come back to where I started, the Fukuyama claim that, liberal democracy was the final solution to the problem of history and that we were all free. If you were in Yugoslavia, you saw, in fact, that democracy arrived as a kind of nightmare. And that the thing about nationalism, the reason that nationalism is so pervasive then and now, is that it answers two questions. It answers the question, who will protect me now? Which is the key question in politics. Who's going to protect me? Who's going to guarantee my security? And the answer to that is ethnic majority rule. I want to be protected by my own people. And that is still the case in, Hungary and Poland and Czech Republic and Slovakia. These places have embraced democracy as a way of expressing a certain kind of vision of nationalism, which is very, very enduring. And finally, I think the other thing to say is that this rediscovery of nationalism was very salutary given the amount of cosmopolitan blah, blah, blah that went on in Europe, that Europe is over nationalism, that we're in a cosmopolitan pluralist world, and not so. You can afford to be cosmopolitan in London, but because you've had a thousand years of, you know, relatively stable democracy, but you can't have cosmopolitan pluralism in societies in Eastern Europe. It's not going to work. And so it was a wake-up call about nationalism, a wake-up call about cosmopolitanism, and a wake-up call about the end of history. There you go. Sorry to go on so long.
No, not at all. In fact, your opening answer has given me about 50 more questions I want to ask you. And the first of which is, I mean, you talked about Europe there. I mean, Europe's been quite important at damping down ethnic and nationalist conflicts, though, hasn't it? The European Union via enlargement. I mean, for all the tragedy of Yugoslavia, it's always struck me that it is amazing that the countries of Central and Eastern Europe managed the transition to democracy, to capitalism, and to membership in a relatively peaceful way, where it could have happened in a far, far worse manner. So would you acknowledge that the European Union is part of the solution here?
To a limited degree, I'm a kind of skeptical believer in Europe. I live in Europe. I've spent most of my career in Europe. There's a lot about Europe, particularly borderless travel, that I use every day. But the problem with accession was that it was based on the premise, let's take Hungary. If you set up a whole set of accession criteria for Hungary, for Poland, for Czech Republic, for all these places, you're essentially imposing an external constraint on the internal politics. So the logic of enlargement is you keep the local political elites under some kind of control, right? And that means that democracy will stabilize. Europe will stabilize democracy by exerting external controls, mostly exerted through control of the purse strings on the structural funds and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Well, the surprise is that the local elites figured this game out very early, and they figured out that the smartest thing you could do would be to run against Brussels, campaign against Brussels as Moscow, tyranny, whatever, Monday through Friday, and then cash the structural subsidy checks on Saturday and Sunday.
Yes.
So it's a double game. And Europe has been outfoxed by this double game for, 15 years. I mean, Orban, the chief master of this game, is now the longest serving prime minister in the European Union. And he's shown all of these guys how to do this. And they're doing it now with, the grain issue with Ukraine. They're just laughing at Brussels and saying, we, the local elite, will decide what grain gets into our economies, whether you like it or not. And so if you live here, you take a rather jaundiced view and a skeptical view of the effectiveness of external control of the domestic political systems of these countries, because the local elites outgun Brussels almost every time. And because Brussels doesn't want another Polexit or a Magyar exit or a Czechia exit to follow Brexit, they all essentially fold their cards when push comes to shove. And that's been a very bitter experience for many pro-Europeans in Central and Eastern Europe, the essential toothlessness of Brussels when faced with these authoritarian populists in this region.
Do you think it's the case? This is one of my hobby horses, but I was sort of thinking about it in your first answer. One of the problems we have is we haven't grounded liberal democracy well enough. Because obviously, when you have group conflict, one of the ways you reconcile that, one of the ways you prevent the tyranny of the majority is by having checks and balances. And it seems to me, looking at politics across the Western world at the moment, here in the UK, in the United States, in many parts of Europe, is that people don't seem to get liberal democracy and how it works and what it should do.
Yeah, that's a key issue. There are two, and this is a debate about democracy that goes back to the very beginnings of democracy. And a lot of political conflict inside any democracy at any given time is actually an argument about what democracy is. Is it majority rule? Or is it what I think democracy is, power checking power to keep the people free, right? A vision of democracy in which the goal of democracy is freedom, the individual freedom of all the agents to choose and select their own life, subject to the law, subject to a commitment to ensure that nobody starves and we have as much social justice as we can possibly have. But the goal is freedom, and therefore a democracy is only as strong as the counter-majoritarian institutions inside it, the courts, the media, and I would add the universities. I mean, people rarely think of the university as a pillar of democracy, but I really do think that's one thing I learned when Orban attacked Central European University in Budapest. He attacked it precisely because it was a counter-majoritarian institution. It got up every day, and universities aren't perfect. I'm as much of a critic of the professorate as anybody, but our role, our function, is central to the epistemology of democracy. That is, our job is to figure out what's true, what's false, and what's uncertain, what claims can be used to ground public debate and public policy. We don't do a terribly good job of it, but we're the only people who do, along with the media, and so we exert a counter-majoritarian pressure against demagogues who claim X is true or Y is true or B is false. And if you don't have academic freedom and the institutional freedom that goes with it, you don't have a democracy. Just as you don't have a democracy if you don't have a free media and people like you doing their jobs. But there is a huge resentment about this vision of democracy, I think for two reasons. One of them is that the counter-majoritarian view appears to give power to exactly those professional elites that demagogues are so effective at inciting resentment against. Nobody likes professors. Nobody likes lawyers, right? So all this stuff about how important the rule of law is, the minute anybody says the word rule of law, people think of judges and lawyers, and many of their encounters with judges and lawyers is not so happy. The social experience of rule of law is very deceiving and very cruel. So that's one reason. The other reason is more basic, which is that majorities want to rule. Democracy does mean that. And so democracy is a constant shift in balance between the power of majorities, the power of counter-majoritarian institutions to guarantee freedom. And Britain has had, devastating debates about that. I think Brexit was a classic encounter between majority rule and counter-majoritarian saying, are you nuts? What do you think of doing? And this is playing out in Central and Eastern Europe, with the addition that Brussels, as an institution that seeks to keep the counter-majoritarian balances working in Central and Eastern Europe, has proven extremely weak in counter-affecting majority rule in this part of the world. Our university was thrown out of Budapest. I had more nice speeches from European politicians than I've had hot dinners. It didn't make a damn bit of difference. Orban went ahead with what he wanted. The European Court of Justice pronounced his actions completely illegal under European law. Didn't make any difference. So this is the reality of Europe. And I don't want to give any aid and comfort to Brexiteers. I'm a Remainer, but I think you can be a Remainer and be utterly skeptical and jaundiced about what Europe actually is and still believe that that Britain should be at the heart of it.
So this is what people of my generation know as an intermission. So while you grab your Kia Ora and your vanilla ice cream, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter, because there you'll figure out everything we're doing and get yourself places to our exciting range of events. Subscribe now.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the thing I'd add about Brexit to the mix is we also threw in that tension between popular and parliamentary sovereignty that we found so hard to resolve.
Yes.
Post post-referendum. Now, one of the things you mentioned was that, you know, one of the functions of democracy is to make sure that the people don't starve. And that makes me think, particularly in the context of populism today, how important do you think has been a failure to deliver in terms of practical policy to the rise of populism? That is to say, you know, if you take the Brexit case, for instance, there's a big correlation between leave votes and median income. Sure. It's the poorer parts of the country that voted for Brexit. So how much of contemporary populism can be explained by policy failures on the part of the old elites, if you like?
Anand, I think you put your finger on a key issue. The most salient fact of my life, I'm someone born after the end of the Second World War, was that we're really creatures of the first welfare state that ever existed, the first state, you know, radically committed in the Attlee government and afterwards, and in the Pearson government in Canada and in Truman and the early Kennedy years, to the same ideal that liberalism had to be based on providing granite under the feet of all citizens, just granite. You know, by granite, I mean schools that are decent, healthcare you can count on, pension when you retire, you know, the basic stuff. And then we ran into the fiscal crisis of the state in the 70s, and people began to chip back at it. At the same time, we saw a skyrocketing of inequality. And so the whole social contract of the liberal state is under enormous pressure from this rising inequality. And the elites who've managed the system did so well from rising incomes that they're incredibly divorced from ordinary people. And so the hatred of the elites, and therefore the hatred of the counter-majoritarianism that they favor, go hand in hand. And this has produced a toxic challenge to the liberal welfare state that I grew up in and gave me my life chances. So we're in a bad way. And I think it calls for much more radicalism than you know, I'm a cautious, pragmatic centrist, but I see now the need for much more radical taxation, much more redistribution, drastic reinvestment in, you know, common social provision. I live in Vienna. I live in a rich society where what I see is these societies are providing world-class public goods for everybody, despite very considerable inequality. It makes a huge difference if you get on a tram and the tram is clean, on time, and the poorest guy and the richest guy are all in the same tram. This sense of public goods has been eroded as well. We need public goods that everybody just relies on, that are very expensive, but are the key to keeping democracy itself functioning.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. There's a very famous quote from Jean-Claude Juncker, of all people, who once said, you know, we all know what it is we need to do. We just don't quite know how to do it and get elected.
Sure.
I mean, all the things you're talking about are quite expensive. It will probably require high taxation. It's all well and good saying, look, we need to, and I absolutely agree with you, these are the things we need to do to prevent populism, to keep a sort of basic sense of collective identity, of society, of common interest. But how do politicians make that case and actually manage to do it?
Well, you know, Tony Blair had a go. I'm not going to try and resurrect the third way or the middle way or whatever the hell it was called back then. I just know, as a liberal who actually thinks you can't do this without a productive capitalist economy, that unless you do two things at once, you're not going to succeed. And the other thing you absolutely have to do is solve the productivity crisis in Britain, but also in Canada. Our welfare state is slowly disintegrating because we're just not producing the wealth we need in order to sustain this. And if you go to the public and say, I'm going to, you know, tax the rich till the pips squeak. I seem to remember that as a phrase from the past. I'm going to tax the rich till the pips squeak. The interesting political fact is that everybody down the chain who are not rich begins to think, ah, they're coming for me next, right? And that's why the idea that you can do this simply by taxing the rich doesn't work politically. So you've just got to get British companies investing in more capital goods. You've got to have a huge investment in training to get people the skills they need to succeed. You've got to do a lot of work on the economy so it starts generating income. And then you've got to manage as a politician the huge expectations that you're going to create. You're going to have to say, look, I know where I want to go, and I'm prepared to take risks, but you've got to understand this is going to go beyond the life of one parliament or even two or even three. We've got to build this country. We've got to put this country back together. And it's going to take a while, and you're not going to like some of the stuff I have to do, but God damn it, this is what we need to do to get there.
That's interesting. I mean, when you look around the sort of, let's say the West as a sort of handy shorthand for the moment, perhaps excepting the United States, because they don't seem to have the same problems of productivity and growth that afflict much of Europe. How optimistic can you be about the future of sort of European liberal democracy and centrism?
Well, I mean, Anand, I have to tell the listeners, lest they don't know this story, that I was in politics and was notably unsuccessful. So take everything I say with a grain of salt about the practical politics of this. I didn't do so well. So that's fact number one. Fact number two is I think we need to look very carefully at why the United States economy is so incredibly productive, because it's a big surprise. I mean, I remember the 1970s when we thought that economy was just rusting out and the Japanese would eat their lunch. And then we thought the Chinese would eat their lunch. And hey, presto, in 2023, they have the commanding position in all the lead technologies of the 21st century. And they have then done something fascinating to me, which is that they have gone to a highly mercantilist, state protectionist public policy that is investing massively in the technologies of tomorrow. And secondly, protecting those sectors against many of their former allies in Europe. And this is a huge challenge for Europe. So, you know, a politician's instinct about productivity is go to a really productive company, a company arm, you know, these guys that make this fantastic stuff, British company that makes all the stuff that's in the cell phones. Sit down with these guys for days and figure out what they got right. What is it that they understand? Take the lesson from them as opposed to, you know, top-down stuff. Figure out what tax changes are necessary, what write-offs are necessary. It gets technical at this point. And then figure out what training you need so that we get the kids at 14, 15, instead of, you know, here I'm going to be heretical, wasting their time with an undergraduate degree at some posh university, going to some training academy that gives them the digital skills and the other skills to get into this economy in the 21st century. Because you simply can't sustain any of the social goods that you and I care about unless you've got an economy that's functioning. And socialism, this is where my criticism of labor is, they're still anchored in a sense that their job is simply redistribution. No, it's not. You've got to get the productive side right. And Canada is suffering terribly from that. Many economies are suffering. The Germans are waking up to the fact that they built the whole economy on a diesel engine that nobody wants to buy. Well, you know, these are the challenges that all societies are facing. And that's where, you know, but the right thing to do is for Whitehall to stop thinking they've got the answers and get into factories where money is being made and figure out how they did it and what they need to do it better.
But isn't it the case that we basically know what we need to do? We need better infrastructure, we need better training, we need to address housing problems. Isn't the fundamental problem of politics now that people don't vote for growth. They don't vote for policies that produce growth. They vote on how to divide the spoils of growth. You know, you don't go into an election saying we need a 20-year investment plan for proper transport infrastructure.
No, I think you have to change the story. You have to say, listen, folks, you know, there's a lot of stories about British decline going around, you know. And so the question I have to ask you is, some of these stories happen to be true. We're just not producing an economy that will give your kids and your grandchildren a bright future. So how do we do this, guys? You know, because we can't, you know, you've got to tell them a story about the future of their children. I'm not very good at this. As I say, my political career was not a success, but I absolutely believe that the problem in British politics, but it's also the problem in Canadian politics, is a problem of hope. It's a problem of making people believe that there's a future out there that they can sign up to. And I think people are willing to make limited sacrifices of a cautious kind, not too much, but some, in order to get there. But they have to have a story, and they have to have a confident story, a story that says, yeah, we can do this. Yeah, you know, I mean, I lived in Britain for 20 years, and at the risk of being sentimental, this is an incredible country. I mean, it's an incredible thing. You ask the British, you get the question right and the answer right, and the British will go quite a ways. But the political system is very degraded. I mean, it's just, it's in a very bad way. Even getting through the noise so that people hear that message is incredibly difficult. And it requires skills that I don't have, and we're looking for a political magician with those skills, and the stubbornness, above all the stubbornness, to keep going.
Yeah, and I suppose one of the problems is if you're asking people to make a sacrifice, they need to have trust and faith in politics, and that is one of the things that has been so awfully eroded over the last decade or two.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the trust and faith has been eroded by a paradox, which is very hard to understand. Every citizen of Britain in 2023 has more information at their fingertips than the Library of Alexandria. And yet the level of ignorance, the level of fantasy, the level of craziness in the political system is frightening. And some of that has to do with the breakdown of all the mediation systems. You know, I, as a student, when I came to Britain for the first time in the 70s, there were mediators, there were authorities, there were, I don't necessarily want to go back to a world in which, you know, the working class took their message for the day from the Daily Mirror and the elites took their message from the Times Leader. Yeah. But God almighty, the collapse of mediation, the crisis of the BBC, for example, our information systems are completely screwed up. And getting through the noise to get that simple message of hope and faith has never been more difficult, paradoxically. And we're struggling to understand that.
I mean, that's fascinating. Because I'm personally a massive fan of irreverence. You know, I remember someone saying to me, we were talking about the referendum of 1975 where we confirmed we were going to stay in the European Community. And someone said, you know, the British people did what the people they were used to listening to told them to do.
Yes.
I think that's very true. You know, all the mainstream press were saying you've got to vote to stay in, all the major political parties. Fast forward to 2016, and the British people just didn't trust any of those institutions anymore. And I mean, on the one hand, that's a good thing. On the one hand, it means that people aren't just sort of accepting the words of their elders and betters, as it were. People are sort of feel more grown up. But on the other hand, as you say, it makes it far harder to build a cohesive society.
Oh, no question.
Sorry, that was a bit of a sermon.
It's a sermon I hear. I hear it in my classrooms. And my sense of this is, instead of, you know, lamenting the loss of mediating authority, what I feel when I'm in my classroom literally every day is I have to go in and establish my authority. I have to earn my authority by saying, look, there's no we in the classroom. I'm going to have to convince you that there's certain things are true, and there's certain things that I'm saying that are true that you should listen to. but it's not like it was in the old days. And I think that's terrific. But it's the same burden that every politician faces. Every politician goes into a room now, and I went through this between 2005 and 2011 when I lost. I had to go into every room, and every person's starting assumption when I walked into the room is, what lie is this guy going to tell me now? And I had to cut through that. I had to find some way to say, listen, guys, I'm not trying to sell you a pair of shoes with a hole in it. I'm trying to tell you what I think is true, okay? And they didn't believe me particularly, but I accept that as the burden of modern politics. You know, Franklin Roosevelt could get up and with his great patrician authority could just bang it through because he was, you know, a master politician, because he's Franklin Roosevelt. But now it's much more transactional. It's much more show me, prove it to me. And I think a modern politician accepts that. It's just the condition of a business. And when you do get a moment of people listening, you can hear a pin drop. You can get through that moment when someone is listening to you carefully and has provisional trust. You know, that's a precious moment in politics. And I believe we can get back to it. But I wish the next generation luck with this, because it ain't easy.
I mean, you wrote a fascinating book called Fire and Ashes, in which you reflected on your political career. I can't let you go without at least talking about that. What prompted you to go into politics, to leave academia and go into what people sometimes call the real world? I'm not so sure.
I was nuts and vain and self-deluded. I think vanity and self-delusion was part of it. I thought if I was good at, you know, being an academic and a so-called public intellectual writer, I ought to be good at politics, because politics is communication. Political communication is utterly different than the kind of communication that you do so well. I mean, it's a different business. A politician has to go into every room and start from the presumption that there is tremendous suspicion, tremendous hostility. Has to start with the assumption that he has to figure out not what these people say they want, but what they actually want, which is a different kind of thing. And one of the key things in politics has to do with standing. People don't talk about this enough. A lot of politics is not a debate about whether proposition X or Y is true or false, but whether the speaker has any right to say anything at all, right? Whether they have standing on a subject. So my problem of standing was, for example, I was a Canadian, never been anything other than a Canadian, but I came back from living 30 years overseas. And people's question for me was, is he one of us? And that's, I think, the primal question in politics. Any politician who walks into a room in, you know, Scunthorpe or Penrith or Glasgow, sits down, and if he's from the south of England or he's a university educator or whatever, their question is he one of us? That is, does he understand us? Does he hear us? Right? If you can't do that, you have no standing. And so nothing you say will be heard. And that's, I think, a fundamental issue of politics. And that's why the increasing inequality of our society since the 1870s has made the question of standing more and more salient. People watch these university-educated Oxbridge types coming to constituencies and talking, and a lot of them think, who the hell is this guy to tell us what we should think? Who the hell is this woman to tell us, you know, what we should believe? We just, you know, she's not one of us. And that's why social class, that's why inequality has been so radically destructive of trust in 21st century politics.
Interesting. I mean, you said Penrith, which is just like something else I wanted to talk to you about, which is...
I wonder why I chose that constituency.
Well, precisely. I mean, I read with interest the review of Rory Stewart's book that you wrote for The Atlantic. And it was a review that perplexed me, because in a way, it slightly contradicted some of the things you just said to me, because you almost sound as if, here's Rory Stewart, he's a guy with vast experience, he's got an Oxbridge education. It is an absolute travesty that the British people didn't take him more seriously and listen to him and let him lead them. Whereas you've just explained to me why they wouldn't, which is...
Well, look...
which side of that fence are you on?
Well, let me declare an interest. I'm a softie. I've known Rory for 15 years, and he succeeded me in the job I had at Harvard. So, I, as they say in Parliament, I have to declare an interest. I didn't think in that review it was my job to tell him why he would never succeed in politics. I think he was a victim of what I've just described in a previous answer, namely the crisis of standing that has emerged as inequality has kind of sundered the political system, and as the media system has cracked apart, so deference to the mediators is gone, deference to, you know, the Cambridge Oxbridge elite is gone, and he was a charter member of various elites, and mm-hmm. you know, he ran into the buzzsaw of that. I think the other poignant aspect of Rory is that, you know, again, this is personal. I happen to know his dad. His dad is a wonderful example of the British upper class ethos of public service, you know, and he was a marvelous man, and I knew him. And I know that Rory adored him. And I just think that Rory thought, I'll do what my dad did. And all I'm saying there is times have changed, you know. And it's a story told against myself. My father was a public servant in the Canadian Public Service. Mm-hmm. I grew up in that kind of ethos. Of taking public service incredibly seriously and without any irony, or let's be honest, without any sense that we were in any questioning of our entitlement to be those kind of public. Well, that culture of entitlement is gone. You have to earn everything now. Nobody gives a damn, you know, where you came from. You've got to earn it. And that aspect of politics, I absolutely support. And I couldn't earn it. I tried, but I couldn't. And I think Rory didn't earn it either. He just wasn't in there long enough to get people to trust him, and mostly get his party to believe him. He's an incredibly able person, and everybody can see it. And so I think he's got a future in British politics, but that's another question for another time.
Michael, I could talk to you for hours about this, but I know you're a very, very busy man. So I suppose grudgingly we're going to have to draw this to a close. But can I just say thank you so much for taking the time. This has been fascinating, and it's given me a lot to reflect on. And I hope we can talk again someday, because it's just been really, really interesting. So thank you so
much.
Oh,
my pleasure. And if I can repay the compliment, I think you know how highly I think of the work you've done in educating and focusing debate on the key issues in your country. I think it's a wonderful piece of public service, and if I can get pompous about it, so thank you.
Thank you so much. I have to say it's unfinished business, but anyway.
Okay.
Thank you.